Hello, this is Melissa, and this is the Redux for October the 6th, 2024. I hope that everyone is doing well right now. I know there is a listener in a distant part of the world who had some heart surgery and is recovering from that, and that seemed to be a success. So wherever you are and whatever you're going through right now, I hope that you're doing well. I wanted to talk a moment or two about righteous indignation. Indignation is anger, so righteous anger. You don't like what you see because it's unjust. It's a moral outrage. And you can't help yourself. You're angry because of this moral outrage. And in Christian teaching, righteous indignation is the only kind of anger that is okay, I guess you could say, not a sin. And I was just looking up the definition of this. Thomas Aquinas said that it's appropriate, righteous anger. In fact, he said, without righteous indignation, teaching is useless. So to be able to see the moral outrage and then communicate that is useful. And Alan had that. And he appreciated righteous indignation in others. There was a story, and this was a cyclical, seasonal story, that enraged me. And I would bring these stories to him. I always was on the lookout for them. And he was angered by them too. But I think I always felt when he covered deaths because of cold and damp, primarily in the UK, he was covering those for me because they just enraged me. And I have got, somewhere on hard drive, I have stacks and stacks of stories about excess mortality, 10,000, 12,000 deaths a year in the UK attributed to insufficient heat. I was listening to Neil Foster's latest Walk and Talk. He sent it to me yesterday afternoon, and I made a little title card. And then I like to, as you all know when you watch the videos, I like to find news articles that are being discussed and put those up there visually. And Neil was on a bit of a roll yesterday. His righteous indignation was showing. And he touched on that story that just really gets under my skin. And I didn't know, it was news to me when he said this yesterday, that in the UK, the winter fuel payments have been scrapped. This happened at the end of July this year. So he mentioned this because he was talking about where does your money go? Well, it goes to Ukraine, it goes to Israel, but it doesn't go to helping your old people, what they call the pensioners in the UK, heat themselves. This is from the BBC at the end of July. Winter fuel payments scrapped for millions. Around 10 million pensioners in England and Wales will lose their winter fuel payments under new plans announced by the Chancellor. From this autumn, those not on pension credit or other means-tested benefits will no longer get the annual payments worth between £100 and £300. This is going to affect a lot of people. And in looking at this yesterday to illustrate the video, I found this fact check, because everything is fact checked now, right? So this is from September 23, 2024. Fact check. UK minister behind pensioners' fuel payment cut does not get heating allowance. Okay. All right, so Finance Minister Rachel Reeves no longer gets a heating allowance, contrary to online claims comparing her to one of millions of UK pensioners denied the winter fuel payment. So it says, okay, well, she doesn't get it anyway because she lives at, I don't know, 11 Downing Street. Who knows? I don't care, because really what makes me angry is not so much a minister who might take advantage of something that she's denied other people. It's the fact that millions of people in the UK aren't going to get this heating allowance. So let's take a look along the lines of fact-checking. This is from 2024, 17 January. Almost 5,000 excess deaths last winter caused by cold and damp homes, charities warn. End Fuel Poverty Coalition warns that vulnerable people left unable to turn on heating because of cost of energy are in danger of dying. This is another fact check, this one from January 2020. There were 25,260 excess winter deaths across all ages in Great Britain last year. A post claiming that 30,000 British pensioners freeze to death every year has been shared more than 10,000 times on Facebook. Depending on exactly how you count it, this figure is in roughly the right ballpark for the number of excess winter deaths in Great Britain. Looking at the average over a number of recent years, it is an underestimate. Are you letting that absorb? Okay. But while cold weather is a major contributor to these deaths, it is an exaggeration to say that they are all a result of people freezing to death. The increase in deaths can be due to a number of causes, such as the severity of influenza outbreaks, and can be influenced by a wide range of factors. So what they're saying is, yeah, there's a lot of excess deaths. Now, do you walk into, you know, your relative's home and find them frozen to death? No, not necessarily. But disease, damage to their immune system by always being cold and damp, these are realities. And these stories, and we don't hear this kind of thing so much in the U.S., but ever since I can remember, since I was a child, I have heard stories about old people forced to eat tins of cat food and dog food because they don't have enough money to heat themselves and feed themselves, or feed themselves and pay any number of bills. So yes, this really gives me some righteous indignation. My Aunt Betty has got a broken heater on one half of her house, which is both heat and AC. And we've, you know, I've orchestrated, cousins have kicked in for this and that, but none of us can afford an $11,000 unit, no matter how we slice and dice that. But she does have, in her big house, half of it is heated with AC. So it's just a matter of accommodating that. And when I got back, I took her to try to avail, you know, take advantage of whatever government benefits there might be. And I told you this, I shared this a while back, that they said, oh, she doesn't qualify because of blah, blah, blah. And this woman who looked like she just couldn't wait to be done with us so that she could eat another box of cookies and play video game, play games on her phone, you know, she just wanted rid of us. And she made the suggestion, oh, so helpful, that maybe it was time for Betty to move into assisted living or a nursing home. And I did not let my anger take over. I did say to her that, you know, Betty was a very independent woman who had lived alone for a number of years, took care of her house beautifully, could drive, etc., etc. And yeah, but basically the little bureaucrat's solution was just die, right? Just die. We don't have any benefits for you, and you're standing between me and my games on my phone and my box of cookies. Another thing that Neil had a bit of righteous indignation about what was going on in Appalachia and the fact that aid was not getting to these people. He had gone into a store and somebody was raising money for the Red Cross, and he kind of went off on her and said, you know, none of that money gets there, and do you know that the director of the Red Cross is making around $100,000 a year, etc. Well, to find a little article for that, I looked up to see what is the CEO of the Red Cross making. Fact check. Does Red Cross really spend only 9% of its money on charity? The claim. American Red Cross pays its CEO nearly $652,000 while spending 9 cents of every dollar it collects on, quote, people in need. All right, so the claim has gone viral. This is from February 2022. It goes on to say that, in fact, the Red Cross spends 88% of its $3 billion budget on program services. Well, that's kind of sketchy, because what's a program service, right? Now, the Red Cross is about the business of blood, okay? Let's distribute blood around the world. That's what the Red Cross does. This is, in fact, what she was making in 2022, not $652,000, but her salary in 2018 was $694,000. Now, heaven knows, I didn't bother to look up and see if it was the same CEO with the same salary, but 2 years later, I'm sure that she's making more than that. So you see, I'm not bothered by what the Red Cross says that they spend their money on. I'm not giving my money to the Red Cross anyway, but I am bothered by somebody making $694,000 on a nonprofit, right? So the fact checking. I wanted to take a good chunk of yesterday and look at what is happening after Hurricane Helene in Appalachia. And it's horrifying. It is some of the worst footage that I've ever seen, some of the worst human suffering. It's so very awful. And if you have eyes to see and can put things together for yourself, and you don't fall for fact checks, what is happening there ought to stir up your righteous indignation. So for people who are not in the States, I just wanted to say what Appalachia is, where it is, so that you have a little bit of a background on that area. I was talking with Ji Und Ji the other day, and we discovered Ji from Scotland, and I discovered that we might be related because we are McCoys or Mackays, as they say in Scotland. So Appalachia is a range of mountains and a location, and it is in the kind of east, and the Catskills in New York are another mountain range, and you've got the Smoky Mountains and the Blue Ridge Mountains. So it's beautiful country. And Appalachia runs like a line, I guess, I don't know, from the part of New York all the way down to Georgia and maybe even Alabama, but it's a long range. And that's where my people come from, right? I'll just claim them as my people. I have no relatives there because it's many, many years that my people moved south and west. But it is an interesting part of the world to me. And I'm going to talk about genocide, and I also want to talk about cultural genocide here too. Because I was raised, you know, proper-like. So we're going to say Appalachia. But there are distinctions, and again, you could call this a class distinction. because in the South, in the core region that is that area, they're going to say Appalachia, Appalachians. And way back in the early 20th century, I read that even though the Appalachian Trail organizations in New England were not in Appalachia, they popularized the use of the sh sound instead of the ch sound. So these distinctions are still in use. Depending on who you are and where you are, you're going to hear Appalachia, Appalachia. But that is a little history there. Now, for those of you who listen to Real History, you'll see that most of the time I use bumper music from the Marshall family. And I actually found who represented, you know, what record label had them. Now, it's a small family owned, and I apologize because I don't remember the record label now, but I'll find it and put a link there. It's a family-owned business. I emailed back and forth with the son of the company, and I said I'd like to use these two songs in my podcast. And I had stumbled on the music the night before I was going to post my very first podcast in January of 2023, and I found out the company, the label, and I emailed them at about 2 o'clock in the morning and said, I want to use this music and I plan to put the first one up tomorrow. I heard back from him, said, you have our permission. I loved that. But I've had criticism. People just can't stand it because they call it religious music. You know, it's bluegrass gospel. This is the music of Appalachia, right? Bluegrass. The Appalachians were settled by what they call Ulster Scots or the Scots, Scotch-Irish. It has a beautiful history. Some of these people have lived there. Their families go back 200, even longer, even closer to 300 years. Independent people and a lot of poverty. So you've got some people right now that have been kind of making buck on their heritage, if you will. And one of those is J.D. Vance, who is the vice presidential nominee with Trump. And he wrote a book, I don't know, about 8 or 9 years ago, called Hillbilly Elegy. And he claims, well, he is from Ohio, and I guess his family comes from Kentucky, and that's part of the Appalachia range. And so he talks about, you know, how backwards it was, how he's a good boy, you know, a good old boy, made good, right? Because he went to Yale and all the billionaires backed him and so forth. But anybody who reads Hillbilly Elegy is going to kind of come away with a less than savory idea about Appalachia. All of the stereotypes, just backwoods, uneducated, stupid people. Yesterday, I stumbled on something when looking up Appalachia. This is from a site called 100 Days in Appalachia, and this was written September 24, 2024, on making it in Appalachia. And this person is a poet and also what you would call a person of color. I am from Appalachia, a native of Webster Springs, West Virginia, a graduate of WVU and West Virginia Wesleyan, a poet, a writer, and an engineer. My father's side of the family traces their roots to Burnsville and Cabin Creek, West Virginia. My mother's side of the family, however, hails from the small Caribbean island of Grenada. So between his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and his recent vitriolic comments about Haitian migrants, who, like my ancestors, come from the Caribbean, J.D. Vance has managed to either stereotype or demonize many aspects of my identity. I won't read this whole thing, but I'll just mention a couple of things. In Hillbilly Elegy, Vance's book, he characterizes Appalachia as a hub of misery, their homes drug-addled and broken, many people from his generation and mine lazy, all of us pessimistic about the future. What this writer says that he didn't see in Vance's book was people like him. Appalachians who grew up in close-knit communities, thrived thanks to family and educators in the region, and made it here due to their support. Similar to Vance, I was raised by my grandparents in Webster, and from the time I was seven years old. But unlike Vance, my family's situation didn't stem from drug abuse, but was instead the result of my mother passing due to an aneurysm after my birth and my father being enlisted in the Navy. He had a stable home and a lot of love and support. And he goes on to write about his grandparents and their working class family. They got to a good place because my grandpa had followed work in unionized coal mines, even going nearly 3 hours away to Welch when he had to. Both of them wanted better for me, and while they knew college wasn't the only way to success, they believed it was the best shot they could give me. There's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because anybody who knows the history of the unionization of coal mines knows that that wasn't entirely on the up and up, and there were a lot of anti-union coal miners in the area back in the 70s, and so, but there you go. It's just a different perspective on Appalachia. What is going on there is so horrific. There are thousands of people missing, and many of them will end up being dead. When you look at some of the film that I'm going to use to illustrate this video, or if you access the links that I will supply, you will see horror. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what else is in North Carolina. I'm going to focus on North Carolina. What's going on in North Carolina and things that we can just ponder. This morning I received a couple of links from someone, and I am going to share those with you. The first link is a video that Aaron and Melissa Dykes from Truthstream Media put out yesterday, and it's very good. It says part one. I didn't see a part two, so I think maybe part two is coming. But in this, Melissa is the narrator of the video, and she is just talking about where was the military, where was the National Guard. They knew that this hurricane was headed their way. She does a little bit of comparing it to Katrina, Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. And let me tell you, that also was a horrendous example of federal response. And I remember at the time watching this and seeing people sitting on top of their homes as water raged by, and their roof, they were just on the roof and maybe with their dog, you know, just waiting for rescue, waiting for somebody to come by and pick them up. And you had at the time FEMA and National Guard giving stand down orders on people, you know, private people who had a helicopter or boats who wanted to get in there and help. But the level of federal mismanagement in Appalachia with the rescue operations, both the advance warning and the rescue operations, it is a horror movie, and it's real. This is real life. These are people who have died, hundreds so far, and many, many hundreds missing. This is heartbreaking. So what's happening? and North Carolina. Just a few things to think about. You have Carolina Lithium. Okay? I don't have a date on this. I think this is all things that have to do with an approval that happened in May of this year. But and this is just from a site, Piedmont Lithium. Ideal U.S. location, strong market fundamentals, historic spodumene, belt. Carolina Lithium is a proposed multi-phase, fully integrated lithium project in Gaston County, North Carolina, with mining, spodumene concentrate production, and lithium hydroxide conversion being designed as phase one, and a second lithium hydroxide train being designed as phase two. We expect Carolina Lithium to be one of the world's only fully integrated lithium sites and among the most sustainable lithium hydroxide operations of its kind. Okay, so they received the finalized mining permit for construction in May of 2024, following the posting of a $1 million reclamation bond to the state of North Carolina. The North Carolina Department of Environmental Qualities Division of Energy, Mineral, and Land Resources approved the permit application April 12, 2024. So they can get going on this. What else is happening there? Well, in the Redux, I'll give you the title in a moment, that I picked to go up, Alan mentioned that in this so-called natural disaster that was happening at the time he spoke in 2007, lo and behold, you had Blackwater training facility there. Now, Blackwater, that's mercenary soldiers. So there they were, right where this natural disaster was happening. Well, Blackwater is now known as Academy. They're mercenaries. It's a mercenary company. And they have a huge training facility in North Carolina. Eric Prince purchased approximately 7,000 acres of the Great Dismal Swamp, a vast swamp on the North Carolina-Virginia border that is now mostly a national wildlife refuge. We needed 3,000 acres to make it safe. There he created his private training facility and his contracting company, Blackwater, which he named for the peat-colored water of the swamp. And you'll hear Alan talk about the name Blackwater. So it's now called Academy, and it's still in North Carolina. What else is going on in North Carolina? And what else might be affected? Here's something from Market Watch. This tiny North Carolina mining town is crucial to the semiconductor industry. Helene just wrecked it. A tiny mining town in western North Carolina was among those battered by Hurricane Helene, and the damage could have serious implications for the massive tech industry supply chain that relies on it. The mines in Spruce Pine, North Carolina, about an hour outside of Asheville, produce a unique kind of high-purity quartz used in semiconductor manufacturing. The town is the only place in the world where the uniquely high-quality mineral can be found in such large qualities and produced for such a low price. The two companies that operate the mines in Spruce Pine said they've shut down local facilities as widespread flooding, power, and communication outages plague Appalachia in the wake of the storm. They go on to tell you what kind of disruptions this might have in the semiconductor supply chain. But I think there's something else at work. Could this be maximum chaos? Possibly. But the semiconductor business is not in jeopardy, I'm sure of that. And any place that has the world's highest purity quartz, where it is cheap to mine, they're going to recover. Maybe not configured as they were, and that's important, but they'll recover. So what else is going on in Appalachia? Well, this is from the same website called 100 Days in Appalachia. And it is under the category of domestic extremism. This is from July 1, 2024. The number of white nationalist groups in Appalachia is rising, and the surge could have implications for democracy. That was the headline. The number of white nationalist groups operating in Appalachia has increased, according to a recent report by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The rise coincides with a national surge of far-right, anti-government, and anti-LGBTQ plus groups, which the SPLC warns could undermine democracy heading into the 2024 presidential election. With a historic election just months away, these groups are multiplying, mobilizing, and making, and in some cases already implementing, plans to undo democracy. In Appalachia, these groups include Active Clubs, the Patriot Front, White Lives Matter, and the Ku Klux Klan. Here, most limit their activity to propaganda efforts, like dispersing flyers or displaying banners on highway overpasses. Okay, so absorb that. This rise of extremism and hate, they do cite a few actual hateful incidents, if you want to call that that, but they're saying it's limited to propaganda efforts. So what is okay is constant pro-LGBTQ plus propaganda. What is okay is constant woke propaganda. But what is not okay is White Lives Matter, right? I looked at another site about the rise in nationalism, and I found this from the ADL. This was 2022. The ADL is the Anti-Defamation League. This is a Jewish, let's say a Jewish organization, the Anti-Defamation League. I don't have the history in front of me. The Rise Above movement plants a flag in the white power music scene. So they've got this creepy picture of a man with a white ski mask, and he's got a barbell behind him, and you know, he's working out. He's pro-white. For decades, white nationalists have used music as a tool to spread their hateful beliefs. In January 2022, the white supremacist Rise Above movement, RAM, and group leader Robert Rundo announced the creation of Will to Rise Records, a music production company catering to white supremacist artists. So they go on to talk about that, and their truly sophisticated guerrilla marketing campaign for the music, and how they target active young white people, like at hockey games and NASCAR races and motocross courses and so forth. They've got all kinds of different organizations in the Appalachia, but these active clubs, Sons of Appalachia, a North Carolina-based active club, encourages listeners to support No Face Nate music, okay? So the skinhead scene, white national socialist black metal festivals in Ukraine are popping up, rap concerts in Italy and so forth. Planting the seeds of future global white consciousness requires total engagement in and influence on everyday life and culture, he wrote. And it goes on to give you an example of some of the hateful lyrics. There's time to cause a ruckus, time to cause a scene, time to mask up like it's effing Halloween. I'm not going to give you the real words here. Deep inside the soul of every white boy is a Bronze Age savage. Okay, so there's an example there. Well, it got me thinking about something that I had seen last week when I covered the Global Citizen Award that Musk was giving to the so-called far-right Prime Minister of Italy, and the music festival that was happening in New York at the same time. I am not going to use any Doja Cat video to illustrate this. There are some of her songs that I won't even say the title of it because it's that crude. But I saw that this is from Global Citizen's website. Doja Cat to co-headline 2024 Global Citizen Festival and advocate for people in crisis. The Grammy-winning star is using her platform to call for an end to humanitarian crises. Well, I can bet you anything she's not talking about Appalachia, right? So it says she's ready to, quote, paint the town red, end quote, because that's the name of her song, the big song right now. So she's known for her electrifying energy, and she will be taking the Global Citizen Festival stage to perform her iconic songs, but more importantly, to inspire the audience to take action to make the world a better place. This year, she is using her fame and platform to advocate for those living in crisis. Well, I guarantee you she's not talking about Appalachia. She said, "We've got to take action to make the world a better place. We all have a part we can play to help end extreme poverty and stand up for equity." Okay, so she's looking forward to positive change. Well, I was just kind of curious about her video, Paint the Town Red. And I'm not going to use it, as I said, to illustrate. And I'm not necessarily advocating that you listen to it, it's foul, or that you watch it, it's filthy. But it was interesting that this kind of, I wouldn't say Baphomet, but there's two devils, the male and the female, and they really are naked. They've got body paint, and they have some baby devil in a kind of like a womb sack that they're holding up. So maybe that is the Baphomet, the half-human, half-animal, male, female, good, evil. But when she's not cavorting with her male counterpart devil with no clothes on, she's wearing red and she's hanging out with the Grim Reaper. It's full of filthy language and disgusting, anti-human, what you might call demonic imagery. But that's pro, right? Right. That's good. That's a global citizen. See, I'm not advocating white nationalism. What I'm saying is I understand when people are faced with the total destruction of their culture, why they go in the direction that they go in. I was looking at one of the Telegram sites and I saw this little, you know, kind of music video thing that was put up that was inspiring people. It purported to be some hillbilly on a horse taking supplies to the Helene victims. Now, what I looked at it and I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. This is straight out of, you know, Hollywood central casting. They're just like, oh, find us a hillbilly, you know, and make sure the hat's dirty and it's got lots of dust on it and everything. And, you know, I clicked on it, I'm listening to it, and it's got rap music. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, if this is all pro-Appalachia, you know, I mean, come on. What does rap music have to do with Appalachia? I mean, I know this is the universal music that they want everyone in the world to be listening to, but really. Well, I checked back on that site later on, and I noticed that somebody said, oh my goodness, how did we fall for that? Look, this person is in the Redwoods, that's in California, right? And there's no mud anywhere, and, you know, he's not hauling supplies and water and food, he's hauling beer. So he's, you know, like going to a party in the woods, who knows, you know. But what I had noticed even before I saw that, you know, it was obviously a music video that the guy was making. I could see the shadow of his cell phone. So he's making his little selfie video, which, you know, he's got the phone hanging in front of him, casting a shadow. So back to the white nationalist groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center saying that the activity that they're seeing in southwestern Ohio, eastern Kentucky, western North Carolina, North Georgia, and elsewhere in the Appalachian region is using holy war and race war rhetoric and fear and disruption that the group sows. They're foreshadowing an attempt to exploit American democratic and electoral processes in 2024. Here's what they say the goal is, right? The suppression of multiracial, pluralistic democracy. So anti-LGBTQ groups are also on the rise. And here's what they did. Oh, dear. In Kentucky last year, in Floyd County, they made some threats against organizers of a drag performance. And then a few months later, other online threats were made against another Kentucky drag performance in a different county. And I read that and I'm thinking, well, hey, maybe the people in Kentucky don't like drag shows, right? So if you're organizing a drag show, why don't you take it somewhere where there's a big demand? Well, what else is going on in Appalachia? Because everyone is pointing the finger at Tesla and the company that supplies for Tesla as being part of this lithium mining operation there. But I got to thinking about lithium batteries and what else that they would be used for. You know, electric cars, I mean, we know it's on the agenda, no private vehicles. Well, I was thinking smart cities are going to need a lot of lithium batteries. So sure enough, and there's lots of companies. I'm just going to put up links. I don't have time to talk about all this, but this is from the Internet of Things, some Internet of Things world site, Commencing the Smart, I guess. Okay, so building infrastructure for batteries in smart cities. It talks about how many batteries they're going to need and the scale and the supply. Even if smart city developers are fully prepared to roll out new battery installations, they may need help to get the batteries they need. One of the biggest challenges facing smart city microgrid expansion today is the battery market's ongoing supply chain struggles. Conventional lithium-ion batteries are in exceedingly high demand, partly due to large-scale electrification efforts. So there's a shortage of mines. The battery infrastructure is crucial, they say. I'll put up some other links of other sites, like Toshiba is talking about powering up smart cities. And there is another one called Interesting Engineering, Smart Cities and Lithium Ion Batteries. Okay, well, that's smart cities, but what about military applications? Okay, so here we've got the U.S. Department of Defense. The DoD enters agreement to expand domestic lithium mining for U.S. battery supply chains. They've released a big agreement. I'll put links here for you. The Office of the Assistant Secretary for Industrial Base Policy, through its Manufacturing Capability Expansion and Investment Prioritization, the MCEIP office, entered an agreement with Albemarle Corporation to support the expansion of domestic mining and production of lithium. Well, where is Albemarle? Well, lo and behold, that's in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. They plan to reopen the Kings Mountain, North Carolina lithium mine to increase domestic production of lithium for the nation's battery supply chain. I just have to ask the question, do I think that the government and private companies are going to allow their most precious and most needed resources to get flooded out? Now, this mine that they're going to reopen, you know, it's been on the go for a while. But what does a flood do? Well, it allows you to clean out what you don't want and rebuild. This is from a site called Defense Innovation, February 2023, Department of Defense to prototype commercial batteries to electrify future military platforms. So the lithium-ion battery has been called, it got a Nobel Prize in chemistry. It says it may have had one of the greatest impacts of all technologies in human history. It's used for consumer electronics, laptop computers, cellular phones, electric cars. But I think, for me, more importantly, is what they call grid-scale energy storage. And then it's got military and aerospace applications. It's just a funny little aside of what I find funny when I have so much righteous indignation about what has happened in Appalachia, is that lithium ion, this is how it is shortened, L-I-I-O-N, lie-ion, lion, 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 a lion, lion. I think that there is a lot more going on. I'm going to put up something from the government energy, the National Blueprint for Lithium Batteries, their plans for 2021 to 2030. Lithium-based batteries are one of the most important energy storage mechanisms that we have right now. Just something to think about. I'm going to quickly now get to what I picked to go up, and I think you'll understand why. October 26, 2007, California dreamin' on such a smoky day, fires and spraying, the people praying. So Alan talked about some fires that were happening in California where they had a Blackwater training facility. And he said, right off at the top here, there's so much going on, but I always like to mention the aerial spraying because most people don't bother. They're so used to it now, or perhaps they don't see it. This aerial spraying has been going on steadily in Canada and across most of the planet since about 1998. And before that, they were testing it out on different areas, primarily in the U.S. and different states, to find out the effects on the public. The other walk and talk, rare down in the Amazon, whose signal is not the greatest, but we're communicating nonetheless, sent me some pictures a couple of days ago of the spraying that was going on down there. And he's, you know, absolutely disgusted. He said, I've been speaking out about the chemtrails since 2009. I used to post memes about it. Many I find go through the internet and come back to me. I did what I could. It's the way that they are saying. So there's a Daily Mail article that he's citing, and I'll try to get that one there. That these forever chemicals have just been found after they started spraying the region 3 months ago. It's as though they're happy to share it and telling us that the spraying here has just started and it will never stop. Absolutely disgusting. Nothing got me or gets me more upset with the sickos than this agenda. And he sent some pictures there of the spraying and the Amazon. And then he went on to make an interesting comment. He said, this is what I think was day before yesterday, we had our first heavy rainfall today after nearly 2 months. The Amazon River is the lowest it has been for many years. It was strange with their spraying these last few months. Wind would come and the feel in the air was that nature was trying to rain but couldn't. That is a lot of rainwater that did not fall these 2 months. I wonder where it all went. 30 inches in one day. Hurricane Helene, perhaps? I get a feeling this is likely the case. Fires in California. Geoengineering. Nobody talks about this. And I've got to say, whatever gets your righteous indignation going, I'm okay with it. But I'm not in the V, no Vs exist kind of thing. The other V, the little V. I don't have an electron microscope. What Earth... the shape of it, it's again, I don't know. I don't have a sextant, I don't know. But what I can see when I look up is constant spraying. Right here, I'm looking out my window right now. It's just a gray, mushy, overcast day because the spraying was so heavy yesterday. It was outrageous. And I said I'm going to bring you more of the kind of new technologies and how they're all pervasive as I can. I was speaking to a woman from Utah who said the smart dust is being sprayed on us. this is part of the bio-digital convergence. And she said, everybody's talking, everybody's caught up in transhumanism. We're looking at post-humanism. I'm going to put up a couple of articles there on smart dust. I'm going to put up some articles on the forever chemicals, because they'd like to explain the forever chemicals as polymers that are industry byproducts. But you need polymers to spray us like bugs day and night, year after year after year. I stumbled on someone that I had not heard of before this morning when I was looking at smart dust and polymers and forever poisons. And her name is Dr. Anna Maria Mihalcha. And some of you might have come across her. I just posted a Real History short this morning. Well, I am, because I'm talking on Saturday. And this was on light wars. And it just so happens this doctor has a lot in her practice where she's dealing with light and so on. But very interesting article that she wrote on her Substack in May of 2024. Smart dust, biosensors, polymers for geoengineering, and the multinational corporations that manufacture them. In this article, I am discussing geoengineering operations, polymers, biosensors, and smart dust that can be aerosolized or injected. First, those agencies and people who deny geoengineering, and let's be frank here, that's everybody, right? Our government is studying these modalities, so it has full knowledge of them. She has heavily cited and linked this. Here's one link. The U.S. government has approved funds for geoengineering research. NOAA will get at least $4 million for a research program, which will include efforts to assess, quote, climate interventions. She talks about self-assembly hydrogel polymers and the historical research in the context of hydrogel smart materials and nanoworms. She talks about patents. I'm scrolling down a little bit in her article. If you do not believe governments around the world have been involved in weather modification warfare for decades, here is a good list of patents that says otherwise. And the link there that she supplies is geoengineering, list of weather modification patents 2020 to 2018. Well, I think I've spoken long enough. I really have, because I've talked longer than this talk from Alan. So I'm going to leave it at that, with a lot of links and a lot of things to think about. I just had some righteous indignation as I sat down to record this. One last little addendum, though. I see an article that I put up that I didn't get to, because we've got to check facts, right? Always check those facts. So we all saw what happened in Maui. That terrible fire just a little over a year ago. That fire that burned a lot and then just left odd things unburned right next to it. I mean, I can link to a real history that I did where he shows some, Mike in Canada shows some amazing images there. But here's the fact check on this. As of October 3, 2024, broken power lines caused deadly Maui wildfire. Well, there you go. The facts have been checked. So, righteous indignation, it's a good thing.
Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix, October 26, 2007. Newcomers, look into cuttingthroughthematrix.com for lots of free downloadable information on the various groups and foundations and societies which have helped to shape this world, and who are the only ones who make a plan since the rest of us are too busy playing, obviously someone else is going to plan your life for you, and that's what's been happening in many generations up to the present. Also look into Alan Watt's sentientsentinel.eu for downloadable transcripts in the various tongues of Europe. And there's so much going on, but I always like to mention the aerial spraying because most folk don't bother, they're so used to it now, perhaps, or they don't see it. But this aerial spraying has been going on steadily in Canada and across most planets since about 1998. And before that, they were testing it out in different areas, primarily in the U.S., in different states to find out the effects on the public. And I don't know if people can look into the various bills being passed in the U.S. Congress, but one was passed a few years ago, which gave themselves permission to use biowarfare chemicals and agents on the public for tests. And that was very nice of them. And since they're the only ones putting the bill through, there was no opposition. And lo and behold, they've been actually doing it. But we've all been getting sprayed pretty well worldwide. It's even in China now, apparently. I just got word that someone came by from China and they saw it happening there. So we're all getting dosed and no doubt tranquilized as well. And probably our immune systems are lowering all the time. Today I was watching spraying in the sky through the clouds. They were actually spraying into the clouds. And you could see the darker spray of the aircraft coming right through the clouds. It's like a knife. It's quite an interesting phenomenon to watch for those that bother to look up. Most people don't, as you well know. In fact, most people have no memory of what the sky looked like because they never looked up at all. And that's what shocks those who do, the ones who still have their abilities for self-preservation like any other creature on the planet. You always look around your environment. That's part of your survival instinct. Most people, you'll notice, don't have it. And that falls right in line with various books being put out there from guys who worked with MI6 and the United Nations to do with lowering our ability to think or reason for ourselves. Most people can't. They truly believe that whatever is worth knowing will be told to them by the media, as though the media was your next of kin. And only about a generation or two generations ago, no one trusted the media because they knew darn well that from ages past, it was all big magnets, political magnets that owned the media. Nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is they've convinced you that somehow they're there for you. They're your brother, they're your father, and they will tell you anything that's really important. So media has always been used for propaganda purposes. Read the books by Jax E. Lull. He goes into it in great detail, and he was a man who was an advisor to various big cheeses, as we say, at the United Nations. And talking about spraying, this was sent to me today. California has been getting sprayed by the orders of Mr. Schwarzenegger. And this is from newstarget.com. It's from October the 25th, 2007. This is from a herbal, I think it's a herbal outlet, a newspaper type thing. And the owner is Rami Nagel. It says here, News Target on September 9th, 2007, several planes hired by the State of California Food and Agricultural Department, flying at an altitude of approximately 500 feet, sprayed the untested biochemical checkmate over 30,000 citizens in Monterey and other surrounding areas. And I'll be back with more of this after the following messages. Talking about aerial spraying and all the other little tricks they're up to, you don't have to worry about the Russians or the Chinese or anyone else, since our own governments are all in cahoots together. We're under a global system, and the whole world's getting sprayed. However, sometimes they go overboard with one particular area and add some more chemicals to the mix. And this is from the Target, or newstarget.com, which is a herbalist organization, I think, in British Columbia or somewhere. And they got a report from California talking about September the 9th, 2007, several planes hired by the State of California Food and Agricultural Department, the CDFA, flying at an altitude of approximately 500 feet, sprayed the untested biochemical checkmate OLR-F on over 30,000 citizens in Monterey and other surrounding cities in California. This occurred without the permission of the citizens. Well, of course it has, because who'd want to get sprayed? The spraying continued for 3 nights from approximately 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. So once again, it's night spraying. About 1,500 pounds of biochemical were dumped on the cities. Many citizens did not even know what had happened when the planes were buzzing overhead. Well, I believe that part. I think if the whole Air Force was going overhead, they wouldn't notice either, most of them. An 11-month-old child nearly died from breathing difficulties. Six-year-old child developed asthma. And maybe you got sick, nausea, dizziness, burning lungs, and muscle aches. That's a new one that's been coming out recently over the last 6 months, is this muscle ache from the heavy spraying we're all getting. So I don't even know if this was the actual drug they were using, that they've claimed to use in California, or just the one they're using everywhere else. And it says here, the excuse for aerial spraying is not a deadly disease carrying mosquito, but a moth whose larvae may eat some leaves off the plants called the light brown apple moth. The CDFA considers the moth an invasive species since it is from Australia. Yet, I like the double speak, yet evidence suggests that the moth has been in California for many years, living peaceably. In response to the moth, the CDFA set up relatively harmless sticky traps, which have captured nearly every light brown apple moth in Northern California region. Governor Schwarzenegger is a strong supporter of the declared emergency. I love these emergencies. Everyone's in an emergency today. It's hype, an emergency, with the new scientists in their white coats being the priesthood, taking over from the old black-robed ones from previous days. And Schwarzenegger says they need to spray untested biochemicals in humans to stop the LBAM from destroying crops is vital. This aerial spraying violates several state laws, well, blah, 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 blah. And then they go through all the different laws. But what's interesting in this particular spray is it's a type of pheromone that's attached to whatever they're spraying. They claim that interferes with the sexual reproduction of these particular moths. And what's even more funny is that this magazine here, this newstarget.com, that sells herbal stuff, has an ad on its right-hand side for the herbal variety of pheromones as well. And I always get a kick out of this, that whatever the regular pharmaceutical agencies do and come up with, whatever they come up with in science, the herbal industry's immediately got a counter for it as well. And they're both shouting that theirs is the better for you. And personally, I don't take any of them. You cannot, when it comes to your health and big business, the two things are incompatible, because everything ends up being business, and the whole idea in business is to sell. And they certainly do sell all of the stuff on both sides of the fence here with tremendous persuasion and money and ads. And you need a lot of faith in either to come through and be fit. But they always say that your faith has made you whole. Perhaps your faith in the products does more than the actual products themselves. So anyway, there's the people in California being sprayed. And what's even more interesting is there were a couple of towns in California where Blackwater, this new private mercenary army, is to be based, and they put in a bid for this particular area around a town. And the town, even though it was accepted by the leaders of the town, the rest of the public were not happy with it, and they were going to change it with the next election that comes up there shortly, I think November. And lo and behold, the town just got wiped out by that fire that started. What a coincidence. I'm really amazed, because that's exactly what's happening on. We're under warfare. This is what's happening. We're all under warfare. The public have had war declared on them a long time ago. And even before the Second World War, and at the United Nations, and at the League of Nations, the precursor of the UN, they discussed all these possibilities of what war was. And they, strangely enough, these psychopaths at the top, came to the conclusion that it wasn't their fault that there were wars. It was the people's need for basic material goods that had them fighting each other. And they said that one day they may have to declare war on the general public and train them scientifically into a new system. Well, that's what's been happening. If you look especially at the US, they've been more open about it because they've had ongoing wars since World War II. Even when we hear the terms war on drugs, wars on poverty, wars on... This comes from presidents. They mean what they say. They're putting something into law. The big police armies that have been built up all across the Western world have been built up under the guise of fighting drugs primarily, which is the biggest joke of all. Because the drug industry has been tied in forever with the secret services. And even prior to what we know as the secret services, the elite had their own in Britain, in fact, in the 1700s and 1800s. And when they flooded China with the opium and the opium wars, you found that even the agencies that worked for the diplomatic service for England were in charge of it and distribution of it. They haven't changed. They simply mutated into MI6 and special sections of MI6. The rest of them don't know. And the same in the CIA. And they flood the world with drugs. Marseille is where all heroin is processed, always has been processed. And if you look at all the riots they've had in France to do with immigration and all the rest of it, you'll never find that Marseille gets bothered. It's always nice and quiet there. Both sides make sure that it's nice and quiet because the drugs must go through. They made movies years ago about that, and it was called The French Connection. And there was The French Connection 1 and 2. They went into that in pretty good detail. It's very hard to get the second one today. It seems to have disappeared from most of the shelves. But that's a fact. Everyone knows it in the drug trade that the big boys at the top are involved in the pushing of drugs. And when you go into the writings of Huxley and others, and even prior to him, you'll find that Aleister Crowley, that was sent out from the regular Freemasonry to start up another branch to get the young ones and the teenagers, the rock industry into it, the music industry, the acting industry into their own branch of Freemasonry. They also coupled it with drugs, and that was his job, was to try and encourage people to try altered states. They've never stopped that trick today. They're still pushing the same thing, altered states of consciousness, because they decided that drugs would be one of the best ways to defeat the intelligence and the intellect of the general public. And unfortunately, the stuff that they've been pushing has worked on an awful lot. During the hippie era of the 60s, you'll find that most of the LSD that was first dumped in America and Canada and Britain and elsewhere was being thrown over university walls in garbage bags. There was garbage bags full of them from limousines, big limos. And these were made by the big drug industries to get the whole thing going. There's nothing better to do. When you want to control people and do nefarious stuff to them, or take rights away, or change the society, or change the culture, you don't want them thinking too straight. You want them to be happy like children in a childish state, doing childish things. And that's exactly what they did. They were told to be happy, make peace, make love, not war, and just have a good old time to themselves. And we saw the effects of that through society. Now, Professor Carl Quigley said himself, the purpose of war primarily is to change society. Because all conflicting sides change, the societies change because government takes over so many roles. And that's what we've seen through all these wars. Wars on poverty, well, there's just as many poor, if not more, today. The UN claims there's more. And they say there's a growing gulf between the rich and the poor. And there has been for 25, 30 years. And it's getting bigger all the time. Let's go back to Freemasonry for a second here. You'll find that the Pope of Freemasonry, Mr. Pike, said himself, one of the tenets of their whole mission was to destroy private property and to destroy the family unit, as it was known. The Communist Manifesto took over from that and basically pushed on that too. And then we find out in recently declassified documents from MI6 and the CIA, they ran the culture industry in the Western world, including Britain and the US as well. They ran the left-wing movements. They funded the artists, the mainstream artists with their nihilistic paintings that drove a lot to suicide just looking at them. They were so awful. And they ran the whole culture industry. They pushed the certain types of entertainment. And I've no doubt, too, they also pushed the whole drug scene as well. because the culture that existed at that time, prior to the Cold War, and the culture we have today is are worlds apart. Not only worlds apart, we've ended up exactly where not only the Communist Manifesto wanted us to be, but where obviously those that funded the Communist side altogether, because communism did not come from Russia. It didn't come from Karl Marx. It originated in London, and it was pushed and funded by the big bankers. They're in cahoots with what's called the establishment. And the establishment happens to be the old aristocracy that have run Britain for 1,000 years. Their cousins also run all the other countries of Europe and are still well in control. Now I think I hear the music coming up. I'll be back after the following messages. Just going through or cutting through some of the incredible things that have been happening in the last 50 odd years and how society has ended up exactly where people prophesied would end up. People 50 years ago, 100 years ago even, because they knew the agenda. And as Huxley and others have said, and Bertrand Russell, they could make the people go any direction they wanted to with scientific conditioning. And that's what we've had, scientific conditioning. One of the main things they had to do a long time ago was to get a standardized educational system so that everyone could be taught the same indoctrinations. Because you take your reasoning from what you've been taught, you reason things out according to the data, and you come to conclusions. But they knew back then that we worked just like computers. A computer has a language, and a computer has a certain logic, a process it must go through. And we work the same way. So by giving you little bits and bytes of information, you use your reason, and you will come to predetermined conclusions as you must. Therefore, when you give the same data to the same to everyone under a standardized educational system, they'll all come to the same faulty conclusions, but they'll all think they're right because everyone else agrees with them. And that's how simple it is. They understood this long, long, long ago. Now, tests were even done in certain very quiet schools 100 years ago in parts of Europe, including England, by scientists, and they found they could rear children in an environment, a closed environment, and teach them whatever they wanted, and the people would believe it. The children would grow up believing it. If they told them the earth was flat outside, they'd believe it. If they told them they'd fall off the edge or they went outside the house of the planet, well, they believe that too. You can make people believe anything in a closed environment. The next part is to get the whole world into this closed environment, and you do it simply by giving them all the same type of education from kindergarten onwards. Now, Bertrand Russell, who was one of the biggest players we've had, that came out publicly with a lot of information and who was all for it, of course. And he was an old aristocrat from a very, very old family in Britain. He was groomed for the diplomatic service, but he ended up being a type of philosopher and mathematician. He thought that through mathematics, they could literally rule the mind. It's interesting, we're going all the way to the brain chip, which works on the binary code, and you think this is all just coincidence. Well, Russell didn't dream it up himself. He worked for the Tavistock Institute, amongst other big institutions that had lots of data on the humanity. We're the most studied species on the whole planet. And they knew they could pull this off step by step, because our lives really are fairly short, and through foundations and institutions which can last for hundreds of years and have their own mandates, they could simply carry it on intergenerationally, and the public who lived in between would never suspect they'd live and die, never knowing that their whole lives and the major events in them were actually planned that way. We take everything for granted. We think a fashion industry just spontaneously comes out with the latest gear, and we wear it, and somehow it's ours. In fact, it's promoted that way. Back in the 60s, suddenly the blue jeans all became popular, pushed again because all the rock stars wore them. And it's quite amazing how we emulate what we're given. We become what we're given, in fact. They say that that perception becomes reality, and the advertising industry has taken over our reality for us. We're taught that you buy things because it's all to do with the material world. You buy things and they just make you happy. You have instant orgasms when you brush your teeth with this particular toothpaste or this brush. And, of course, it's all lies. Whatever problems we have can only be dealt with inside our own minds, not with what we get from outside. But the advertising industry is there to completely alter your perceptions and give you placebos, basically, very expensive placebos too. Russell said they'd have to take the advertising industry on board in this quest to dominate the minds of the public. And sure enough, they combined forces back in the 1940s and 50s. And here we are today. Most folk can't tell fact from fiction. And how they do it is they aim the next part of the culture at the kindergarten. They take children that have been inducted this year, and they will give them certain little ideas. It's called predictive programming again, little stories they give them. And based with emotion, what would you think of a person who did this? Would you like them, despise you? Then they make you feel really bad and guilty. And then when that person grows up in 40 years' time, they'll change certain laws and rules, and the people will adapt to them very quickly. There will be no prejudice or whatever because they've been brainwashed since birth. And that's how simply it works. You have to get the speeches of Beria, who worked for the secret police of the NKVD back in the 1930s, and he gave speeches to the Comintern and International Communists committees, open speeches that are published. And he talked in 1933, I think it was, about the ability at that time to upgrade the culture every 7 years through scientific indoctrination. In other words, put into the youngsters major possibilities of particular changes so that when they came along in their lifetime, they would think it was all natural. Now, I think there may be music coming along. I can hardly hear. And I was talking about Beria, the head of the secret police in the NKVD era of the Soviet Union, when he talked about the ability to literally indoctrinate and change culture and upgrade it every 7 years by intakes of seven years between children intakes, basically, and how they could put new ideas, and therefore everything they'd experience in their life would be programmed from an early age. And the intake that would come the following year would be a little bit ahead of the last lot and so on. And that's how you literally do it. And it's been done the same in the West as well. It never dawned on us that we were going through exactly the same process as the Soviet Union. And I used to wonder about that myself when I was young, because I thought if this was a war, as they kept telling us, a war where science and technology would win, those with the best technology and weaponry would win, why would they have meetings between all your top scientists from the US and Britain and Europe and the Soviets every year? These were the last people you'd put together, for goodness sake, supposedly, when spies were turned, as they say, and all of that kind of thing. Made no sense at all until you clued in and realized, no, this was a fake war where both sides were being taxed. One side was using mainly its muscle, the other side was using its money, but you were getting taxed to create high technologies in a wartime situation where no one really complained. That's what wars are also for. You don't complain when most of your labor has been taken back off you in taxes to keep you safe. And so they were using all of this money to do high technology and also funding big scientific institutions that studied human nature and psychology and behavioral psychology. And they were sharing all this information between the two sides at the top because, as I say, the war is really on the people. Always has been on the people, and the people don't know it. And it's interesting, even in the movie to do with the Skull and Bones movie, I think it was called Bones, the first one they put out there, even showed you that they had a place called the War Room, and War Room was written on the wall. And that's what it's all about, because their job, supposedly, to all of us profane ones, all of us in the darkness, is to enlighten us, and if we can't be enlightened, then they must rule us like sheep and train us and use us too. They have no problem in using us. That's what the profane really are for, according to the higher Freemasons. Now, I think we've got Rick from California on the line. Are you there, Rick?
Sam, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Alan. It's good to talk to you. The reason why I'm calling is because you mentioned the California fires, and I had to call in because I'm living in the area that's affected.
Yeah.
And I wanted to share a couple things about it. Can I do that?
Sure, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, I was noticing there've been like lots of protest flyers out in the preceding weeks about Blackwater, Stop Blackwater. And you know, I didn't go out there because I don't have a vehicle, but it's in this little town called Potrero.
Yeah.
And then when the fire broke out, the first fire, it was on the border, it was on Potrero. And I kind of laughed, you know, and I said to people, I said, you know, it's kind of funny that the fire began right where Blackwater was supposed to be. It's probably a cheap way to clear the land. And I was, you know, and I was saying it.
Yeah.
And people just say to me, oh, you're being paranoid. And
it's all coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah.
They live in coincidence theories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention that the fire is a full-on disaster area. I mean, there were thousands of people, upper-class people, being evacuated. And many people came to bring food and clothes to the stadium. It was just like New Orleans.
Yeah.
And the National Guard was here, and FEMA was here, and George Bush came, and Chertoff, Homeland Security, came to my city. And I find it also kind of funny that it happened right the next week after this top-off drill in Portland.
Yes,
and
another coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, in a court of law, this is what's interesting, taking it for granted that the guilty never admit they're guilty,
yeah.
You come to conclusions in a court of law by the preponderance of evidence. And everything stacks up every time against the authorities, and yet we still go around chewing the grass and not looking up. It's quite amazing how we've been trained not to use our own reasoning anymore. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, and certainly if these coincidences always fall in favor of what they want, well, you know darn well they're doing it.
Yeah, I also want to mention that, of course, you know, that the news, they came out, they were looking through things to blame, and all of them are lower class. It could be the migrant workers burning fires, could be a smoker throwing his cigarettes. And the first thing I thought was, oh, gee, I wonder what laws are going to come up with as a result of this fire.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting that it was a Dr. Day years ago came out after being at top meetings, and he said that the agenda was to eventually get everyone out of the coastal areas, especially. They don't want people living around coastal areas in this new world order. And they said they would use, or rural areas, and they would use fires, and they'd burn them out. And that was back in the 1960s, I think it was.
Why coastal areas? I never heard that before. It's interesting.
Yeah.
No, why coastal areas?
Well, I think part of it is that coastal areas, people can jump into little boats and get away or do what they want or smuggle or survive, basically.
Wow.
And I think that's part of it. They want everyone, and I'm no doubt, too, the elite eventually one day with a much reduced population want the worker bees all inside where they have the coast to themselves to go sunbathing and playing themselves.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much, Alan.
Okay.
I just wanted to share that with you. Have a
Thanks
nice day.
Thanks for calling in. Yeah, that's true enough. Though the people, the residents there, have had petitions up, and they hoped, they were actually raising up this new petition for the election that's coming in November. That I guess it's a local election to get them out and reverse this decision, and bang, within a week and a half, they're burned out their homes just like that, and Blackwater gets its way. And what gets me is, I mean, Blackwater is going to be a new private army. Eventually it'll blossom and be a world army. And they used to call the Blackwater the underground stream in the occult and masonry, and Rosicrucians called it that too. Water underground would appear black, you see. So they called it Blackwater, and it's the underground stream. And so here they are using the very terms and all the rest of it. And the people, again, just go on chewing the cud. And accepting this, a mercenary army is going to be based in California. These guys are killers for hire. Killers for hire. That's their profession, is killing. Not handing out bread or pretending they're from the UN, and it's a lot of pretense there too, but actually killing for hire. And they have only one master, and that's their paymaster. And they're not responsible to any Geneva Convention or anyone else or any international laws because they're private. They're privately owned. And that should get us all terrified that this is happening. In days of old, they had the Praetorian Guard to go around Caesar to make sure that was their own henchmen. That was his private army that would stand by him through thick and thin. And yet here we have the same thing happening here. It's going to blossom onto a world scale, and we're all going to be booted around by private armies, just like these creeps in Star Wars, the faceless ones that you saw, the numerous numbers of them. They were just bodies for hire. That's what's coming here. And I always find it interesting in the U.S. that was the first country that was openly Freemasonic from its very beginning. You might say from its foundation. And all of its insignia and emblems and so on, and a lot of the speeches of the founding fathers. And they said that they'd modeled it after ancient Rome, looked around at all the systems that pre-existed theirs, and they came up with Rome. Well, who on earth would want to emulate Rome that was an empire? And Rome lived off the backs of every country that it conquered. That's what it did. It was really a fascist-type state. And yet here they are with a private army. And so should we really be surprised? What is surprising, as always, to those that think, is that most folk don't think at all. They're not even concerned about it. I don't think much would concern most people, to be honest with you, anymore, except everything that comes along. And there's a lot more worse to come. There's no doubt about it. The whole agenda for Agenda 21, the United Nations Agenda 21, the agenda for the 21st century, is all coming down. And if you look into even the map there, they have for Agenda 21 and all the areas will be rewilded and all the rest of it. Lo and behold, right where that fire was, there's Blackwater's military base right there on their map. Have a wee look into that. And that was done a long time ago. So nothing happens by chance, nothing happens spontaneously. Everything that happens is planned that way in a major scale. And that's how you keep control of the world. That's how you guide the direction of the world. And here we are. We're living, we're going right through it. We find that 100 years ago they wanted a vastly reduced population. How do you get it? Well, Russell and others talked about the problem of helping the people by inoculations and killing off diseases and at the same time raising the population. It was counterproductive. And so Russell himself said the best thing they could hope for was another black plague, a black death. And Malthus said that long before him. I'm sure these characters were all related, no doubt, or interbred down through the ages. And they all had the same agenda. Well, look at the death rate today. It's skyrocketing. Everyone's coming down with cancers. The industry's gone from the shores of most of Europe. And there's less smoke. They're not burning coal fires like they used to. And yet lung cancer has gone through the roof, even though about 80% less people smoke or have ever smoked than before. Start thinking we're being killed off gradually. And that's the best way to do it. By the least point of view, it doesn't cause panic with the people. And even young doctors now are coming on the news. And they've been taught that it's quite natural that one out of every two will get cancer, or even a few cancers, and then die off with it. They're taught that's normal, where the doctors of 30, 40 years ago were taught about all the different kinds of cancers and how rare certain ones were, one in 10,000, 20, or 100,000. Now they're told the opposite. They're told pretty well one out of two is going to come down with cancer. And that's what you always do. You must brainwash those who are going to work on the people. They're to get the most indoctrination. That's why they're called doctors, indoctrination. And they've been doing it. That's the bad news. They have been bringing us all down. There's hardly a person today who has a complete immune system left. I'm sure that the inoculations they gave us when we were young, that was part of the agenda, was to help destroy the immune system so that eventually something simple is released that we should be immune to or would have resistance to could probably kill us off quite easily. I can remember when the first so-called bubble boy came out, the first boy with a complete allergy syndrome back in the 60s, and that was a novelty then. And they showed it on television, BBC and so on. He had to live in this huge bubble complex with filtered air and all the rest of it, because he was immune. He was allergic to everything. That had never happened before. Now, what what had changed over the years, while the inoculations had been stepped up and the polio vaccine came out, and I'm positive the polio vaccine was the worst one that was ever given, because it's admitted to now there was over 100 monkey or simian viruses. They call them simians. That's why you have the Simpsons, the closest thing to it. And you have simian viruses, live simian viruses in every shot. And the simian 40 virus had one purpose. That's what scientists came up with that later looked at it. The one purpose that simian 40 virus had was to cause cancer. And who gave us this particular inoculation? The great Dr. Salk. What was the history of the great Dr. Salk? Dr. Salk was a top eugenicist in the Eugenicist Society for many, many years, who wrote about the necessity of culling off the population. So the wolf changed his clothing and became a hero, and he's still applauded today. We should start thinking for ourselves, and for those at least who still have the capacity and ability to do it, because we're being taken down pretty fast. And it's shocking to see how many injections and inoculations now babies are given. They're hitting them before their immune systems are even working. And that's why they end up not working so well after all. That's the bad news. And how easy it is to do it when you've trained the public. Once again, like Jacques Ellul said, all entertainment is propaganda. Because along with the story, you're being propagandized. That's why most entertainment on television or in the movies is to do with detectives, the law, I wouldn't call them service, but the legal system, and also medicine. They elevated doctors up to the superhuman ranks of gods, and they're the new experts that run our lives. And people within one or two generations now believe everything they're told by doctors, as indeed the doctors do themselves, since they've had more indoctrination. But the facts stand out for themselves as well. And when something happens in life, since nothing evolves, I've never seen anything evolving in my life, since nothing happens by itself, then when something changed drastically within the human body, where it's the falling sperm count down 75% of what it was, an average Western male to the 1950s male, it doesn't happen by itself. And they discussed all these. They published their findings at the beginning of the 1900s, in the middle of the 1900s, and even today they published their little documents on reducing the population and what they'd have to do it. And lo and behold, if you start thinking about it, you realize that they actually have been doing it. I can remember when the political leader for the Quebec Party in Canada came down with the flesh-eating disease some years ago. A little quip in the Toronto Sun just happened to mention, and he lost a leg, I think, from it, Mr. Bouchard. The Toronto Sun had a little appendage onto the story, and it said that his Bouchard's wife and daughter both had minor flesh-eating disease symptoms on their upper arms. And I thought, well, where are the inoculation sites for upper arms on the thigh or the buttocks? Where did Bouchard get it in his leg? Which tells you that the upper politicians you see are always given injections for up-and-coming diseases long before the public hear of them. And certainly, but even when they have antidotes, etc., the public will never, ever hear of them. That's why they changed the laws in the Western world when Mr. Manning was in Canada. And they gave all politicians and their families coverage, complete coverage, under military hospitals in times of crisis. That would be excluded from the public. They wouldn't get in at all. And it all makes sense. Now, in every batch of inoculations, you always get one that's more virile than others, and someone will come down with the actual disease itself. And I think that's what happened to Mr. Bouchard. I'm pretty certain his family also had the injections, and that's why his wife and daughter both had symptoms of it in their upper arms. Again, simple detective work. That's how you work on things. You use your reasoning. Something that's in short supply today. So, yeah, I don't give you the good news, and I don't flog any antidotes to it either. I just tell you that the bad news as it is, and at least some of you who have children can perhaps make a decision as to whether to go ahead and have more and more injections. Never mind just the mercury. You have no idea what those injections really are. And just tidying up before the end of this talk, talking about democracy as well. Democracy over 100 years ago was debated as to where it would go, because it would evolve. You see, they're talking about evolution. If they make it happen, it's called evolution. Everything does evolve in your laboratory or discussion group. That's where things are really evolved. And they talked about the evolution of democracy, and that democracy, since it deals with primarily large groups, like Jack Zilal talks about, then eventually the large groups would dominate and be the new type of government over the public. And if you didn't belong to a large group, you'd be voiceless, you'd have no say whatsoever. And lo and behold, that's what's happened. But what they didn't tell you was that the largest groups in the world would be the big fascist corporate groups, the new feudal overlords that Mr. Carl Quigley talked about, and he thought it was just wonderful. He was all for it. He being a historian for the Council on Foreign Relations, which had helped to bring it all about. But that's happened already. We're run by CEOs of corporations under the guise of NGO groups, backed by the money as well from the big foundations. And these foundations were mentioned for the last 200 years in Masonic books written all along those periods, and boasting how they would take over and be the masters over the masters of the world through the takeover of money and power. But what they didn't mention at the time was they would use this term democracy, something they made for themselves, knowing that through time, step by step, like the old song goes, time has gone on my side, intergenerationally, they would become the only ones with voices loud enough to be heard by the governments. And they made sure of that because most of the people in government have been the CEOs of the same corporations and now lobby them. We're run by the big fascist elite. And it's interesting, as I said last week, or at least earlier this week, it's interesting that in the Congressional Hall, where presidents make their speeches, you'll see the two fasci, one on either side of the stage, the wall. It's on the wall, the bundle of rods covering the axe, an ancient symbol. The Romans adopted it, in fact, came from the Etruscans. And if you try to get a bundle of twigs together and break them over your knee, it's very difficult, but take them one at a time and they break. So the whole idea was that they'd all stand together. They'd be terribly cohesive. They'd always stand up for each other. The British used to call it closing ranks. When one of their members was discovered playing with little boys or something, they'd close their ranks and keep quiet and all stand up for each other. Well, the fasci is a symbol in the US, and that's what we're under today. Fascism is alive and well and never died. It was never conquered. It's always run the system. And it also has learned a lot from its counterpart that it created and funded from the beginning, called communism, the big laboratory, where they both worked together collecting data and making high-tech equipment that eventually would run all our lives via satellites and so on. That's where the technology for the chips all came from. The Cold War, they rush ahead and they go centuries ahead in a matter of 40, 50 years in technology because of unlimited financing and personnel. Well, from Hamish and myself, up here in Ontario, Canada, on a rainy night, it's good night to me, your God, all your gods, go with you.